And now, Hangar 56 Media presents Spike's Car Radio, a downloadable cars and coffee, hosted by writer, comedian, and automotive enthusiast, Spike Ferriston. Now, here's Spike.
Here we are.
And here we are.
And here we are, Zuckerman.
And here we are.
On Memorial Day.
2020.
I know. A few days before we post this show. Happy Wednesday to all of you. But today it's Monday with us. It's a beautiful day here in LA. It's a quiet day. Zuckerman just came rolling in a 300 SL, which I forgot you own that car. That could be the ultimate quarantine car. You were in it. You were in that kind of driving ether when you arrived, right?
I was in that ether all the way from West Hollywood down Sunset Boulevard. It was a glorious ride. Perfect temperature, perfect behavior of the car.
Was
fantastic.
That carnesia that you were experiencing? Had you forgotten about this car?
The car was downtown, and the battery got weak. And I had that moment, I think you call it the Spadermats moment, where you do a minor repair to the car and feel excessive satisfaction.
Correct. Named after James Spader.
Yes.
A phenomena he first noticed.
And yes. And he changed his mats, his floor mats, was that it?
It was his mats. That's all he could do, is he changed the mats in his 911, and then he found he loved the car even more.
That's exactly it. Now, the battery.
What did you change?
Well, the battery was weak, so I had to hook up a charger. And in all of these years, I have never had to do that on either the Gullwing or the Roadster, because they have a battery cutoff switch that you just turn off the minute you're finished with the car, and that saves the battery. So I had to determine where the battery is. There is a compartment behind the passenger seat. You have to pull up the carpet, and then there is a hatch with two Phillips head screws that you have to carefully remove so you don't scratch the leather, and therein is the battery. And it's kind of clever, because you imagine it's a counterweight to you as the driver, and it's in front of the rear axle. And I got a charger, I hooked it up, I charged it overnight, and
it held.
Perfect.
I find batteries go every 2 years. Every 2 years, they suddenly just go down.
Yeah, but I did love the car much more once I got the battery working.
Are you confident now that the battery is going to hold a charge?
It held it really well. Last
you know,
night,
you know, the real test is tonight with the lights on.
Oh, yes. What I think I'm going to do is I will order a new battery and have it on standby and probably change it out before too long.
This is such a big step, Zuckerman.
To be in advance? To be
no,
proactive?
This is something I've been trying to get you to do, which is, you know, I won't even go as far as to say wrench on your, just start working on your cars, because look at how excited you are. I do this all the time. I love it. And I'm learning more and more about it. I've yet to put my hands into an engine, but I do the electric. I do the little thing. I'm doing stuff to the Zagato right now.
Mm-hmm.
We have
a relay.
There's a little directional relay switch that's malfunctioning. Those things are 50-50 anyways. They're like bad grenades. I can't wait. It's coming tomorrow. I've been waiting the whole weekend. I've been waiting till tomorrow.
I need to drive that car. We should go out Zagato and 300 SL. The 300 SL
we'll do that today.
Is such a technological tour de force. It's so unbelievably technologically advanced for the time period in which it was created. And the sound of the mechanical, the direct fuel injection, the mechanical nature of it as you accelerate, it's unbelievable.
This is great. We've got to get you a hydraulic lift in here.
Why? And then, so I can squash you?
No, so we can look under cars and do stuff to cars. This will be great. See how happy you are that you wrenched on it?
Because there was one of the original strip bars in San Francisco was Carol Doda's. She had
the original what?
Carol Doda was in one of the original strip bars. She had a piano.
Strip bars.
Yeah, she had
okay, where are you going with this?
She had a piano on a hydraulic lift. And the manager and one of the girls was having sex on the piano as it was going up and down, and they were squashed against the roof.
This is one of your cases?
No, this was in the 60s, Ferriston. I'm just giving you some.
And where do you read a story like this in the 60s? You were a toddler.
It's
kind of like now.
Everybody knows it.
Everybody knows it? Oh, okay.
Everybody knows Carol Doda.
I think you're the only one in this audience.
I'm sure Jerry
There's
would know.
There's no one right now listening to this anywhere raising their hand going, yeah, I knew that. piano lift story.
I'm going to tell you a story. You want to know how I know this?
Wait a second. Before you continue on, I just want to say, we have a great show for you today. Andreas Pruniger, president of GT department, Porsche, is going to be on the phone with us in a minute, all the way from Germany. So if you're getting bored of this conversation, just hang in there for a second.
Oh, you're going to like this.
I know. I do like it. I'm just saying, if there's anyone else there who clicked the button for Spike's Car Radio, Andreas Pruniger.
Anyone else on the show?
Our hero. No, we're just Andreas today. Calling from the Porsche factory. I couldn't be more excited. I mean, he's
the man.
He's our hero.
Mr. GT3.
Right. Okay, continue.
I'm going to tell you. And here's how I know the story. In 1983, my parents were in San Francisco for a medical convention, and me and my college roommate drove up, and my mother, a little bit crazy, said, "You should go to Carol Doda's. There's this place." and so she gave us some money. I couldn't believe she was sending us to a strip joint. I don't know what she thought it was. It was more of a clip joint. So me and Guy Glazer, a.k.a. Gus, we go to Carol Doda's. It's a really bad strip bar. I've never been in a place like this. We sit in a booth, and these girls come and sit in the booth and say, "Can we drink champagne with you?" So we go, "Of course." And we're spending the whole afternoon and early evening drinking with these two strippers, and it's time to leave. And the bill comes. I had no idea I was paying for the strippers' drinks. And they wanted like $500. And
yeah. Oh, man. And so, boy, what a classic story this is.
But here's the best part. This is a young Zuckerman in action. They came in and I said, "I'm not paying." And they said, "We're going to call the police." And I said, "For what?" And they said, "Because you're not paying your bill." And I said, "You're also serving underage drinkers." And so we can talk about that, because I think I was only at that point, I don't know if I was 17 or 18, so they threw us out without making us pay.
Wow.
Yes.
Your mom.
My mom.
Sent you into that situation.
Yeah, but it was a great learning experience.
Yeah, no, we've all been there. Actually, I haven't been there, but
I got the drinks for free. I was quite pleased with myself.
That is pretty good that you got out of that situation. You're just now flashing me back to a moment where we went to a club like that when I was 16 years old in Massachusetts. It was so charming back then.
What was it called?
I don't even remember. But they just let us right in. See, it was with my friend Brian Jackson. And Brian Jackson was the oldest looking 14-year-old there was. See, there was no older looking. He looked 28 at 14.
Hairy monkey.
Huh?
Was he a hairy monkey?
Yeah, and I believe I was 16, and he must have been 14. But he looked like a dude, right? Just a ranch hand drinking Budweiser beer. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And we went to the strip joint in Brockton, and they let us right in. And we sat there, and I remember there's this old-timey dancer up there dressed as a nurse, and she put her stethoscope on our chest. We couldn't have been more excited. It was one of the greatest moments of our lives thus far that she was doing. And of course, when we left, and serving us alcohol, by the way, when we left, we had to tell all our friends at high school what had just transpired, which turned out to be a huge mistake, because both of us were dating these very lovely young ladies.
Who soon found out.
Who very quickly, like within the space of an hour, it was like in the air, like COVID just were in our faces. That was my learning experience.
Yep.
One,
never
just
talk.
Keep your mouth shut. And two, you know, this is what jealousy, this is the type of stuff you shouldn't do. If you're dating this nice young lady, you shouldn't be doing things like this.
We had two places in my hometown on Long Island, and of course, they were named perfectly. One was called Club Personal Touch, and the other one was the Tender Trap.
The Tender Trap. Oh, the Tender Trap. Yes.
Yes, indeed. These were good times in the 70s and early 80s.
Yeah.
You're getting wistful now, Ferriston. You probably wish you were back there with Brian Jackson.
No. No, I like Brian Jackson. We talk. These people are all on Facebook. We all get to communicate, but... No, we spoke about this last week. Yeah, I'd love to go back to Massachusetts. It'd be great. But
die an early alcoholic death.
They're doing fine. They're all doing fine there.
Sure, they all look like they're 90.
I'll tell you who's not, though. Have you seen any of those that video of the Ozarks with these people just partying like there's no pandemic? It looked like an episode of Jason Bateman's show, The Ozarks. Like this was some sort of money laundering scheme. It's 1,000 people like in a pool by a lake. just on top of each other.
There's so many different realities. There are so many different realities at one time.
Well, we're all fine. We're doing doing really well. A-OK. The Zagato, I've been ringing it out. I've been driving it and putting together a little punch list for Mr. Wilhoit. Now we talk about this with newly restored cars, which, you know, newly built by Zagato, gone off to have some mechanical work. The 110-100 rule. Drive it 1 mile, put together a punch list. 10 miles, punch list. This is, I would say, 100-500 mile punch list that we're putting together. The directionals, I think I have that, unless that's a grounding issue. I'll know that tomorrow. There is a small vibration coming from under the dash toward the end of the front boot in. Now, if you're gonna report a vibration, you have to be able to recreate it, right? So, if you drive 35 miles an hour in fourth gear, that's the decibel and the whatever the vibration of the engine that makes this dash vibrate or under the dash. Now, last night, I think I narrowed it down to the windshield wiper arm. You know those old 356 motor wipers? Those units, the arm, you know, they're just loose.
It's a contraption, yeah.
So I went under the dash and I taped up the piece I think is vibrating. I will let you know. That's all I have so far. That is all I have, that little vibration and this little blinker relay switch. So I'm going to... Once I put that thing in here, I'm going to drop it back down here this week, and you've got to drive it a little bit.
I will drive it, and I really do think we have to ask Wilhoit to machine an arm for the rearview mirror. The listener should know that this has the 356 rearview mirror, which is fine for a 356 roofline and rear window, but we have such a cut-down roofline and raked small rear window that you cannot see out the rear of the car, except I think within 5 feet of the back end
you
of the
could.
Car.
You if could. You were tall and you needed to push your driver's seat back, you would have a perfect view. I did it the other day.
It's actually if you were short and long-legged, though. Somehow your torso was quarter-sized and your legs were... You have to be lower.
Yeah, but you can make this adjustment. But it's... You know, I like thinking about this, Zuckerman, because this is one of those cars you can... You know, like a 550 or an RSK, you can put these little things on to make it more drivable, and it still becomes part of the lore of the car, right? There's no period correct, really. It's you're going to make this correct with a car like this.
I like to see what's coming up behind me, particularly when I'm in a small car.
Yeah, you're right. Because, forget it.
It's a
Diet Coke can.
Yep.
If you get nailed, it's a Diet Coke can.
What did you drive today?
I'm in the Aston Martin DB11 AMR.
Wow.
630 horsepower of Aston Martin greatness. I will tell you, this is the first Aston Martin I've gotten in that I absolutely love. This is a perfect Grand Tour, 2+2. And they've got all these things that they figured out about, you know, these complaints we've had about Aston Martin, right? Again, I apologize for my voice.
Phlegm.
Well, I can't get my allergy shots anymore, and all this stuff comes back. Anyway, this car, and Johnny Lieberman said it the day I got it. I put a picture up, hadn't driven it yet, and he goes, "That's a really good car." Didn't know what he means. Now I know what I mean. And I discovered it on the highway, driving down here a couple times, that this is the car I would want to do a long road trip in. It is eminently comfortable and quiet when you want it to be, and a nice big fat race car when you don't. It leaps from 80 miles an hour to like 110 in a very nice planted lightweight way, and then you can take it out to dinner, take it out to the supermarket, have a nice little quiet drive, and you're actually comfortable. They got this car right, Zuckerman.
Does it share a wheel, a platform with other vehicles?
Well, the other DB11, I would bet.
Yeah. It's just, I look at the car, I think it's really good looking, but then I start to think about how long the wheelbase is. It is a tremendously long car.
It is, but you look at a 365 GTC4 Ferrari from 1972.
Right.
That's what that is, right?
Right.
And that's the kind of, what I like about it. That's the grand touring feeling about it. It reminds me of that car. But unlike, you know, the Superleggera, which was a muscular, brute. It's a different, that's a British muscle car. Think of that as James Bond's getaway, right? Where he's sliding and going nuts. This can do that, but it can also do the basic 911 thing.
My partner, Robert, and I, we looked at a Superleggera. We were going to do a plan Z on it, but I really...
They're monsters.
They're monsters, and I just had trouble wrapping my head around that price point. Is so
this high. One would start... This one would seduce you. So I think this sticker's around $250, and I don't know what... You know, they didn't put a Maroni in there, so I don't know what the end result is.
It's a Maroni. Only...
Maroni MSM.
Oh, I didn't know. So yeah, we.
The one stupid thing it doesn't have Apple CarPlay. You got to have that, all right. You got to have that, and for some reason I don't know if it's available in the DB11. It's just not in this car, and it's needed. It's expected. Connectivity is expected. However, I do like this car a lot, and it really surprised me. So well done, Aston Martin, DB11, AMR. Which I'm guessing what?
Aston Martin Racing.
Is that their version of AMG?
Yes, sir.
There it is.
Now you know.
Now you know.
If you don't know, now you know.
All right, in a minute, we're calling up. Should we call him Andreas or Andy Pruninger? I see him on Instagram as Andy Pruninger.
I think we should.
But I see him everywhere else as Andreas. Are we like Star Wars nerds talking to, you know, Jar Jar Binks?
Who's the guy who created J.J. Abrams? It's kind of
we
like
have some
J.
pretty
Abrams.
Big names on this show, Zuckerman, and yet we're probably the most nervous about this one. Why?
Well, why? Because he's the Pope of our church.
He's the Pope of our church?
Yes.
He is? He's the guy?
GT3. He's the guy that between the gods of cars.
Yes.
He translates.
He does.
From the gods to the people.
You're He's right. So that's why. You know, get ready for a name drop. If you don't want to hear this name drop, you should. Please don't take pictures of me while I'm talking.
Oh, shut up.
I don't. I like the way I look right now.
It's already deleted. Go ahead.
Okay. If you don't want to hear me name drop, you better. If you're too sensitive to hear a name drop, you should mute your
ears.
Yes, right now. Just cover your ears. But Mr. Seinfeld.
No.
Wrote a bunch of questions for us, too. I couldn't figure out the technological how to get everybody together for this one because if you imagine, we got like a walkie-talkie with three mics sticking out of it. How to have Jerry call in and Andreas from Germany. I couldn't figure it out right now. So he's written a lot of funny questions, too. Did you read his questions?
I did not see.
He admonished you for your questions. Did you see that?
Yes. And then he felt bad, I could tell. He was nicer to me after that.
He was?
Yes, he was.
Well, he was saying, this is my area of expertise.
And he's right.
And you should stop. But I liked your questions, Zuckerman. I thought your questions were kind of the same as mine. I think what he was saying was, those questions have been asked and you can Google them. And he is right about that.
Except for the fact that most people haven't. And most people do want to hear the story of how did you get into Porsche and
we're gonna get it. I'm gonna get into all that. But there were other questions. Yeah, it didn't matter. That was just Jerry being catty. It was funny.
He's being critical. Yes, he's the.
But I think
the
between the three of us, me, you, and Jerry, I think I've got it covered. I've got a list of all of the questions right here. The one thing we're always trying to get is information about future models. And I don't think we're going to get
we're
that.
We're not going to get anything.
we're not going to get any of that, nor do I think we upset Andreas. Maybe he'll offer a tidbit or two. But here, Zuckerman, listen.
I'm listening.
You're reading your phone. Listen.
I'm looking at questions.
You have one of those eagle. You have the highest degree of perception of any of the people I know. All right? The way Pruninger works and the Porsche guys work is they'll be in the middle of some mellifluous like a description of something, but they'll drop a little clue in there. You have to hunt for the clues. So I want you to use that eagle ear of yours to go, now, wait a minute. In future, just listen closely, okay?
I will listen with my ears, and I will listen for the clues. He is extremely keyed up and nervous about revealing anything. You know that.
I know, but they always will say a little detail, a little morsel, and then if you can hear that, and call him on it, and he gets quiet, we know we have something.
A morsel. I think in German, that's a schmitzig. A schmitzig.
All right, here's a free ad for my brother, Wally Ferriston. You know who Wally is, right?
Wally's your brother.
He's my brother, not just my brother. I nicknamed him Wally because we shared a room for 18 years, and he has asthma, and he wheezed. So I called him Wally the Weasel. That's what I was like growing up. But now he's Wally Ferriston. Look at that. He's turned it into a positive.
And you guys are Irish twins. I like that.
We're Irish twins, separated by 11 months, no birth control. Thank you, Roman Catholic Church. Anyway, he is the cue card guy for Saturday Night Live, for Jimmy Fallon, for Seth Meyers, for all these shows in New York. Cue Cards by Wally is his company. And guess what? He's got a new business. He is selling personalized cue cards on the internet, Zuckerman. It's a birthday. It's a graduation. Maybe it's a funeral. I don't know. He will write out a cue card, just like the cue cards they use on Saturday Night Live, and sign it, make a little video, I think, and send it off to you for a little bit
of money. For a funeral. Applause.
Yeah.
Cry.
This is what he wrote. He goes, what you can get is anything you want written on the cue cards. It's original. You can be clever. I can help you decide. If it's your best friend's birthday, I can write live from Miami. It's Katie Smith's birthday, or live from quarantine. It's me going crazy. These can be great birthday, graduation, anniversary gifts for you, your family, and friends. Okay, so here are the payment options for you. You don't need to know that. All you need to do is go to Cue Cards by Wally on Instagram. Cue Cards by Wally. It's C-U-E Cards by Wally on Instagram. And you can DM Wally, or you can reach him at cuecardsbywally@gmail.org. Cue Cards by Wally.
Not Q-U-E.
Do you think it's at gmail.org or gmail.com?
I would say gmail.com.
Gmail.com, yeah. Maybe that's the wrong thing. All right, let's try and get Andreas on the phone. Are you there,
hey.
Andreas?
Thank you. I'm here. All the way, 8,500 kilometers away in beautiful Black Forest, Weissach. It's 6:30, so mainly the people have gone already. I'm the leftover here in the office talking to you. You're the last point on my agenda, but I'm thrilled to be in the show. Thank you for inviting me.
Now, do we call you Andy or Andreas? Which do you prefer?
Andy is shorter. Everybody calls me Andy. Andreas, my mother calls me Andreas when I'm doing something wrong, or called me when I was a kid. So I'm not used to Andreas. I don't like Andreas, actually. I like Andy better.
I would prefer.
So,
I would guess.
Call me Andy.
I would guess it would be Andy, because Andy is lighter than Andrea. There are fewer letters. There's fewer, less
exactly
weight in
exactly
the name.
And it sounds better, which is very important for my products as well, I think.
Well, thank you for joining us. If you don't know Andreas Pruniger, he's the Porsche GT boss. He's the guy who makes all of our favorite cars. You're here with me and the real Zuckerman. We are huge fans of your work, so we're so excited to have you here. And we just got a lot of questions about, you know, how you got your start in all of this. I'm guessing, let's just start with your Taproot car. What was the first car that you drove that where you knew that you liked these things?
Well, I have to really think a long way back. So the first personal car I owned and what I loved, it was a VW, actually. It was a VW Scirocco. It was a Scirocco, a GLI, and it was the comfort version, I'd say, of the GTI variant. So it was a very lightweight coupe with 110 horsepower, 1.6-liter four-banger. And I modified it heavily. I put an exhaust on it and lowered it and put white wheels on that thing and sport steering wheel and everything. So I bought all the tuning shops empty almost. It was dark green, had silver stripes, and it was a pretty fast car back then. It was a 79 model, when I remember right. And I turned 18 in 83. So it was 4 years old. It was already rusty. quality got a lot better these days. And that was maybe the first car that my first car ever. And I modified it a lot and took stuff out, like the rear benches, and wanted more sound, and experimented with tires and so on. That was the first one. They were followed, I think, by several other VW Golf GTI 16 valves, and then I had this possibility to get a Lancia Integrale, a Delta Integrale, and that was a cracker back then. It was a four-wheel car, and then a former rally car was the homologation variant of a rally car, and that was the car that I loved most from these early cars. And on all that cars, I was tuning a little bit and making them lower and making them a little bit faster. And that was how it began. So I loved cars. And from the first point I had one, I knew I want to do in my business life, I want to do something that has to do with cars. I want to be an engineer and want to work on cars, want to think about cars, want to invent cars. So that was pretty much when I turned 18, 19 that these thoughts came up. But, the Porsche thing started a little bit later.
And what did you learn? Now, you weren't happy when you're modifying cars. You weren't happy with what the stock Volkswagen was delivering. So are there moments in these modifications, like what were you seeking when you're modifying a Volkswagen Scirocco?
It was mainly because I was curious how I could affect the car's behavior in changing whenever I changed something, like what's the effect when you put in wide wheels, and then I put on wide wheels and wider rims and noticed, okay, now the center of gravity is too high because the car corners better, but I've got this nick and yaw and roll, so I needed a stiffer suspension, and then when the stiffer suspension, the lower suspension was in the car. I noticed, okay, the steering doesn't feel as good anymore. So I had to try around a different brand of tires. And the aerodynamic thing wasn't too big because I was 18, 19. So the car was going like, 110 miles per hour. So aerodynamic doesn't kick in big time at that speed. But that was more the trial and error game I was playing. And I was curious of what happened when I did something to the car, and the lighter it got, and the better it cornered, the better I felt about it, and so it was a trial and error game and continuous improvement, if you put it
like that. Continues until today.
Yeah. Now, where did you shake these cars out? Where were you testing them?
Well, back then it was mid-80s. The Autobahn wasn't as crowded as it is today. So everybody in America thinks, oh, we are driving 300 kilometers per hour every day. That's not the truth. There's so many limited zones here, and there's so much traffic. So you hardly can test a car on the Autobahn or on a normal country road anymore because the traffic got so heavy. So back then in the 80s, so there was a little bit more space everywhere. So you could go to the Black Forest or to the Swabian Alps. There's winding roads that are really good and no traffic, no police. That's an important point as well, because we went fast that days, but it was accepted in a way, so nothing happened if you get caught. Otherwise, today, it's a little bit different situation.
Wow. And friends, did they have their cars, or was this a lone venture out in the woods?
I mean, you always look for friends that have the same mm-hmm. same interest in the same things, and so we formed a little group of car nuts, young car nuts. They had Golf GTIs or all these little Opel 2 liters and all these hot hatches that mm-hmm. that we had back then, and we met on the weekends and in the garage of friends, and helped each other out with working on the cars. We were like five or six guys with different cars, and then we got more and more, and there was a little bit of a scene that was developing around us, which was really, really cool. It was nice to hang out with the guys, have a beer in the workshop, and talk about stuff we wanted to change on the cars, and talked about when we could afford what.
Right.
That was a big issue back then as well, because we were still going to school or university, and so you have to be pretty inventive to try everything out, and you have to know some people that could lend you some stuff that you could put on the car and evaluate. So, it was a pure hobby. It was a pure hobby back then.
So,
and that turned into a little bit of a more professional thing when I in parallel to my studies, I hired at a magazine that tested cars. It's the biggest magazine in Europe, I think, Auto, Moto, and Sport. It's like Car and Driver or Road and Track over in the States. And they let me drive the cars for photos. So, and I really took part of this journalistic way of evaluating a car, and went with them to the racetrack every Monday, making the measurements like acceleration and top speed and stuff, and even lap times. And I learned a lot from the guys that were doing the testing back then. I was maybe 24, 25 when I started that, and I almost spent every day there and really working for this magazine instead of going to the university. the result was the study took a little bit longer than I actually planned, but I learned a lot. Mm-hmm. And from then on, I knew exactly I wanted to work for a sports car manufacturer.
Now,
that was the igniter, I would say.
Is it at some point your dad takes you to Weissach R&D, right? Isn't that the moment where you make a decision that you want to work for Porsche? And if I'm not mistaken, I thought I heard you say once it was a 73 911 RS that you saw that inspired that.
Both is partly correct. So the 72 Carrera RS was a poster that I posted above my bed as a kid in my room. So that was the first. That was the car I adored and admired most because it looked so fierce with his blue stripes and his ducktail. And an uncle of mine had a 911, and I loved the sound of the car when he visited us. And I spent the whole time circling the car or sitting in the car, and I think the car would have to need windscreen wipers on the inside because I was playing driving a car all the time. That was the story with the 72 Carrera, which was the first 911. That was the car that drew me to the 911. And later on, when I was going to the university, my dad was working in the supplier industry, had an appointment here in Weissach. That I think it was mid to end 80s as well, or mid 80s more. And he asked his contact here if he could bring his son. And it was strangely a Saturday because we had to go on a day when nobody was working, because he sold as a sales engineer the scale underneath the first wind tunnel here in Weissach. And so we needed a wind tunnel when nobody was in to check all the installations. So that was a Saturday, and we had to cross some workshops here, and I marveled at all the cars, all these 911s standing up on the stands, and we were looking a little bit left and right, and I saw this car that had a drive shaft that went from the back to the front, so it was the first mule of a C4. Mm-hmm. So that makes it makes it mid 80s. That's correct. And I pointed out, hey, this is a four-wheel driven 911, and then they snatched me away from it. I said, you shut up, come on here. You can't go there because I deviated from the path we were taking through this workshop all the time, and they really had to catch me all of the time and get me back to my dad with a smile, as a matter of fact. But everything I saw here in Weissach when I was the first time over here was so fascinating and so intoxicating for me. And I said to my dad when we went home, oh, Pat, that's exactly the place I want to work for. And that was in the mid 80s. And I was just beginning or was in the middle of my studies.
Right.
But then this absolute conviction was, I have to work for Porsche when I get out of this university.
You just knew right at that moment. And so the stepping stone, I think, into Porsche is, weren't you at some point a Porsche driving school instructor working up in the mountains?
Yeah, that was in my early days when I came to Porsche. So I hired here. My first working day was the first January of 97. Mm-hmm. Because I applied to Porsche in the mid 90s when I finished my studies all the time. I mean, for everything every job they were advertising for, I put into my CV. But back then, in the beginning of the 90s, it was hard times for Porsche. They didn't hire. So I got all these folders back, and it was really disappointing. But I kept going. I didn't accept that as a failure. So when I wrote them at least 20 applications, at least. And some of them stayed here because really on my first or second day when I was here, my first boss came over to me and gave me all this heap of folders that is collected here in the company. He said, okay, you can have all that back now, so you finally made it.
Wow, and, that's
and he
so
said,
funny.
What I don't understand are the different colors of every folder has a different color. They're looking like if all the RSs were parked in a museum. It was yellow, it was red, it was orange, it was green.
Yeah, did you
and,
use classic?
I still have them, actually.
Did
I
you use classic Porsche colors
and, yeah,
for those
and,
folders?
On 97, I started here, and and they asked me pretty fast, pretty quick after I began here, if I would have interest in being a sport driving school instructor, because they knew I was coming from this automotive sport magazine, because I learned a lot there on the track, and some people noticed in my first days here that I know how to, that I knew how to handle a car, and that I was not too bad at explaining things, and so I ended up at a sport driving school, and it was really cool to spend the weekends on the tracks and drive the cars and meet the customers, and that was something I did very intensely.
Right, you know, imagine being a driving instructor, a scary job because you get guys in cars. Maybe you're going to drive you into a wall, but also it's a good opportunity maybe to hear from the drivers what they love about a 911, what they love about a Porsche, and I would imagine that customer feedback is important to you as a GT car designer. And it's fun for you to hear that stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, back then when I was a sport driving school instructor, which was only a second job, it was an add-on to your normal job, which took place at the weekend, I like to hear the comments and the feelings of the people that owned the 911. And what was really, really an experience I didn't expect was the passion that was behind all mm-hmm. that. The passion of the people and the relationship they had with their car. And everybody, I mean, the 911 seemed to be a thing for me that makes people happy, really, which is a healthy thing. Yeah? You have something that makes you happy because everybody loved it. But everybody was very involved in the 911. Everybody had, like, ideas how to be able to improve this or that and had their opinions. And I loved this one-on-one conversations with the customers, and that I saved that in my memory somehow. It was a very important base platform of customer knowledge I needed for the GT job that came a little bit later. But I quit being a sport instructor, sport driving school instructor, almost as soon as I was doing the GT projects, because it just took too much time. And after a while, when my name got a little bit known in this small niche scene, you always had people calling you for days after the weekend and wanted advice on this and that. That was just a little bit exhausting. And but it was the time I had a family back then, and I had to look for the family at the weekends. But still, I was in contact with a lot of customers. I still am, and like to listen to them and talk to them and keep this channel open.
I remember a conversation you and I had in Atlanta over dinner over the upcoming 911R, and we were talking about weight reduction, and I was giving you all my harebrained theories on how much weight should be pulled out of a GT3 to make a 911R, and we were having a lot of fun. One of the things that I remember you saying is, you know, I tell a lot of customers, Spike, not you, but a lot of American customers, why don't you lose 100 pounds? That will make the car much lighter.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
That's one of
maybe.
My favorite
moments. Sometimes I'm too direct, but maybe on that special, even on that occasion, as I remember, there was nobody in earshot. That was too heavy. So that made me say that.
Well, you were making a really good point.
It doesn't matter. I mean, no matter how much you weigh, you still can be a freak for light cars, and that's fine. That's okay for me.
Well, you made a really good point. And you were more less talking about that, though, because we were talking about people who take the air conditioning out of a car and the buyers who take radios out, pulling too much stuff out for not enough weight reduction. And you were saying that in your opinion, it was not the right thing to do because a rainy day is going to come along and you're suddenly going to have, you know, fog on the inside of your windshield, or you might want to listen to the radio, or it's going to be hot. You want to have your AC on. Talk about, like, you know, it just with respect to ordering a new GT car, how far is too far with weight reduction as far as options?
Well, it's a good question. It's a very individual question. But if you want to use the car, I would say, I mean, there's collectors. They hardly drive their car, which is a pity. I know those people. Most of them are in the U.S., actually. They wanted the lightest spec possible just for their own, for their own pleasure. And but there are others that drive the car. And if you drive a car on a regular basis, I don't think you should save on an AC. And even for us, we always discuss internally if we really want to offer one option like that, because even on the RS model, just to give you some numbers, less than 2% of the customers worldwide ordered a car really without AC. Everybody's talking about weight, but when it comes down to ordering your own personal car, everybody ticks the box of AC. Why? I mean, clearly, I mean, if you drive a car without an AC through the rain, it's going to fog up. I mean, when we are testing cars, I remember a situation. It was some years ago. I think it was on the first JT4, on the 981. I had to stop at the road, at the filling station, because it was raining so hard. I couldn't see out anymore because the car was fogging up completely. And you need dehumidify a car, you need an AC. And in today's cars, I mean, we've got the cooler front on the car, so all the cooling liquid passes underneath your seat to the engine, goes back and forth. It heats up a car pretty good, especially in warmer temperatures, and especially when you track the car. So I think to make an RS slower, just delete the AC. You might be lighter, but you're so exhausted after 10 minutes on the track, you want to get out and then take a breather. And so you need the AC. It makes the car faster, actually. It makes you faster because you feel better. So the AC is something I really would recommend to always put in the car. And it's standardly included in the car. You have to deliberately put the cross on AC delete on an RS. So most people wouldn't do that. And everything else, I mean, is it's a very down to personal taste. I like PCCB brakes because they're really lighter. The rotors are a lot lighter, and they're rotating unsprung masses. And if you compare back to back, they really feel better, even on the steering wheel. You brake a little bit later, and the response of the suspension is a little bit better. So this is something I'd really go for. So if there would only be three options I could take on a GT car, it's definitely PCCB, definitely. And maybe the most important option for me personally is the bucket seat. You need a good seat in the car.
Yes.
Where you sit low, where you have the perfect seating position, and it's lighter too, than the sport seat. The widest spread misinterpretation of our option list, I think, from talking to customers and from what I experienced, is people think the normal sport seats are more comfortable. They're not. They're more comfortable to get in, more comfortable to get out. But the more comfortable seat for long journeys in the car, I drive 10, 12 hours in that seat, and I'm sensitive in my back because I'm a tall guy. I have never anything. I mean, I'm getting out like I got in, and that is not the case on a sport seat. Although it's a little bit more lushly upholstered and looks maybe more comfortable, at the end of the day, it isn't. So always go for the bucket seat. I know they're expensive, but they're light, they look good, they increase the value of the car, and they increase the fun you have in the car, because you get more into information into your body. There's more information, there's more conversation between you and the car if you sit properly in the car and if you're engulfed in a seat. Definitely.
Okay.
So it's PCCB. It's the bucket. It's a bucket seat, and it's don't delete the radio. You wanna listen to Spike's radio, right?
You wanna listen to some AC/DC.
You wanna listen to Spotify.
Aren't you a classic rock fanatic? Don't you love AC/DC? Isn't that your band?
It's one of my bands. I got a lot of bands, and AC/DC is clearly a band of my youth. I love their guitar riffs, so I love to work on my amplifiers and guitars to get exactly that tone. It's a little bit of an obsession of mine, but I love all kind of classic rock. I mean, I even like the Stones. The Stones are a little bit older than me.
Yeah, they're great.
But I like their music, but I like the newer stuff as well, or newer, like the 90s stuff, like Green Day, Offspring, this garage rock thing. And it has to be melodical, and it has to have a lot of guitars in it.
Yeah.
I don't like this lead guitar sound so much. I like the rhythm. So my favorite band is Status Quo, but it's not so well known over in the States, I think. But my favorite, actually, and people, if you're into rock, look out for that band, are the Lazies. The Lazies from they're from Canada, I think. Great band, great rock.
Do you know the Lazy Suckerman?
I don't know that. I'm going to look it up, though.
Yeah, we'll have to look those up. All right, here's another option question for you. The one I know everybody wants me to ask. The question I'm sure a million people have asked you. PDK versus manual when you're specking out the car.
Wow, this...
Now here, let me be more specific.
Let me
be more specific. In a GT3...
I vividly remember the first discussions we had when we brought out the 991 first gen. We could only afford to develop one gearbox for the car, and it was the PDK, because it was faster. We were under pressure from the competition, but our approach was so much different to the more automatic transmission approach to the standard Carrera. And I think at the end of the day, I had to do a lot of talking, including the quote slipped me, shut up and drive, when people were talking to me about the theoretical things, and the car was standing there. Hey, try it yourself, shut up and drive. I think if you have the choice, it's a very good thing. So we're looking for giving the customer the choice, his own choice, whether to take a manual or a PDK. On the first generation 991, we couldn't, because a manual transmission was not in the budget of developing it at the same time. We did it on the second gen then, which was welcomed and found praise all over the world. And now we have the lucky situation that we have both. My personal opinion, very hard, because I've got a board with a lot of keys on it, as you can imagine. And for me, really, it's a matter of mood, which mood I'm in. Mm. Do I want to shift, or do I want to enjoy a PDK? The way it is executed in a second gen GT3, it's so emotional, it's so much fun. I mean, this acoustical thing, an add-on, I would say, the PDK has, you cannot get that on a normal manual transmission. The downshift, the blipping, it's really very emotional. It's so much fun, even especially when you're short shifting, like if it's a little bit rainy and you shift it like three quarters of a throttle opening at 5,000, bang, bang, bang. That's a lot of fun. But if you put the pistol on my head, I would say, if I would have to choose a GT car to keep forever and it's only be one.
Drum roll, please.
I might turn into a manual, because I'm getting old. I'm 50-ish now, a little bit more, and don't want to spend all my weekends at the racetrack anymore, and I just enjoy shifting so much. If the shifting mechanism is perfect, there's so much shifters out there that are not worth mentioning. You have to get it right. It has to be fun. It has to be rewarding. But I think you can say that for...
What was the... let me ask you this. Out of the, all the GT cars that you've worked on that have come out of your department, what's the one car you feel like, or the first car where you went, you know what, that's the one we got right?
I think we got all the cars right, because I'm a very stubborn guy when it comes to perfection of the final product, and so is all my team around me. We're really, really very concerned that the customer gets 100%, because we consider ourselves the customer, because we drive the cars the same as the customers do. Luckily, we don't have to pay for them, but we don't own them as well. That's a downside. I'm happy with all the cars, to be frank with you, and it's not a marketing or not. I'm evading your question. I mean, it's the same thing. If you ask a father of 10 children, and you ask him, "What's your favorite child?" You wouldn't get a clear answer, I think.
Yeah, well, if you give him a couple of beers,
I really enjoy
you.
The GT2 RS most. Ooh. Because when I have to travel through Germany somewhere, this torquey engine, this brute of a car,
yes,
it can really be so entertaining.
Yes.
But at the same time, I mean, during this Corona shutdown we just experienced, the car in my garage I used most, because I took it out of the company to have something to drive and to some evaluations and but just because I wanted something to drive,
so
that, the GT car.
So wait, the GT2 RS was the car you were driving the most?
Excuse me?
The GT2 RS was the car you...
Did you get that?
The GT2 RS?
No, it was not the GT2 RS. It was a Spider. It was a 982 Spider.
Oh.
Open car, manual transmission. We have this wonderful
open air
green one.
See.
It looks almost like British Racing Green with gold golden wheels. I really loved that car, and I did a lot of miles in that thing. And it was such a rewarding drive. I wouldn't have traded it in for anything else at the moment. When the weather is good, I really like an open car.
Right.
The same goes for the Speedster. And it's really depending on my own driving mood I'm in.
Right. Let me ask you this. I had heard, I was talking to someone I know and who also knows you, and he said that you said about the GT2 RS, hold on to that car because we're not going to be able to make anything like it again. Is that?
I can't hear myself talking like that. I mean, if you have a GT2 RS, yeah, you should hold on to it, absolutely. Because, I mean, we're always trying to up the ante, I would say, with the cars we do. And I think we owe that to our customer base.
Right.
But it gets more and more difficult, I would say, to meet all the worldwide regulations like emissions,
right,
and sound and sound emission as well. So all the rule makers, all the different countries want the cars to be quieter and quieter. I think this is a big thing on a GT car is how it sounds and how it transmits emotion over the air. For others outside, maybe not as much as the one that's driving it, but this is part of this race car. This race car gene thing that you hear the car have, and I can openly say that when I look at the rules and laws that are coming up in the mid 20s, I would say, there's just no legal possibility anymore to make a car that sounds so emotional and has so much voice. This is definitely a point.
Is that?
I think technology gives us opportunity.
Is that the most difficult thing you deal with future models, as far as the constraints put on by other countries? Is it sound the biggest one, or fuel efficiency, or weight, or what is your biggest challenge when designing these future cars?
Sound is only one of them. I mean, noise emissions, I think sound is a very, very, very important USP of our car, and we need, this is our high-revving six-cylinder engine that has a relatively low displacement for its power. We need to have a free-flowing exhaust, and we don't have an engineering target make the car loud. That's definitely not the case, because the sound comes through the surge of horsepower. We need a free-flowing exhaust with less restriction, with low restriction, and physically this is loud. If you have a lot of space available, a lot of package space that you can put in an exhaust with a lot of volume, what you can when the engine's in the front and the exhaust at the back, but that's not the case in the 911. There's limited space we can use for dampers. So this is only one challenge. Emission side is another one, especially over here in Europe. You're in America, you're not as strict when it comes to emissions regulations. What a difficult word, my goodness. But we want to homologate the cars worldwide, so we have to meet all the targets of the different countries. That's one thing, which is again something that influences max power, because if you want max power and max revs, you have to put in gas, as a matter of factly, and you have to fit in all catalytic converters and other filters in the exhaust system, which takes up space and clogs it up. So this is another thing. Another thing is weight as well. The crash regulation, safety regulations, they're harder to meet on every model I made in the last 20 years. It was always the point almost that you have to 50 to 70% of the engineering capacity you have to invest in getting the same performance out of the new car, fulfilling new regulations in comparison to the old one. And the rest of your capacity you can use to make it better. This is a rough guess. This is just to give you an idea how we have to cope with ever-changing regulations worldwide. And this is the challenge, definitely. And if you look at tires, for example, tires have to be good in the rain. Tires have to be as quiet as possible, and that influences how good they are on road holding. If there's laws coming out that the tire noise can't exceed whatever decibels, then the tire manufacturers, they have to put in stuff that is making them less noisy. But the problem is to find a way to make them even stickier than the one before, which calls again for a lot of knowledge, technology, time, money, to get all that right. So we always are chased a little bit by the worldwide boundary conditions. That's a challenge, but it's fun. And till now, I think we succeeded. So I wouldn't say that there will not be another Porsche that's as good as a GT2 RS.
Interesting.
I don't think that would be true. But it's very hard. It gets harder and harder to do something like that.
Was that the comment, Zuckerman, right there?
When
he talked about the GT2 RS when he said, I wouldn't think.
Yes.
Was that the one we were listening closely for?
Maybe. Now, Andy, this is Paul Zuckerman. I was fortunate enough to have two 997 4.0 RSs. That was a very limited production car, 600 cars. But I noticed, I had a white one and a black one. The black one seemed to be a better performing car. Is it possible that with such a limited run that individual cars can have different personalities or vary? Or was it my imagination that I was just thinking the black car was better than the white car?
In what regard? Road holding, precision, steering, field, performance of the engine?
I found the performance of the engine in the black car better. I found the sound better. And I found the clutch to be slightly less heavy.
Mm-hmm.
But the engine seemed to rev a little freer. The acceleration was slightly stronger.
Did you compare it back to back, or was it just a feeling when you operated the car?
It's just a feeling when I operated it.
And that's exactly the problem.
Yes.
I mean the performance. Let's address the first point: engine performance, RS 4-liter. In that time, and that goes for today as well. Every engine before it came to the car had a dyno test. And so we monitor in Zuffenhausen every engine And I can easily say that there was not one engine in the bunch of 600 that was like more than 4 or 5 horsepower apart from the other. So the bandwidth of these deviations is very, very low on that cars. So it can be that over run-in time, I mean, it depends a little bit how you brake in the car. Mm. It always is a good idea to give the engine a little bit of an easy time in the first, let's say, 1,000, 1,500 miles. That doesn't say trundle around at 2,000 RPM, but drive the car properly, warm it up properly, all that thing. Slight changes or slight differences can develop if you treat the car differently. Mm-hmm. On the gearbox, they should be all the same, I'd say. Maybe there was some production, or even some supplier differences in or variations in the parts behavior. I don't know. So we have a lot of cars, mostly when we're doing the development work, that are one and the same. And every car has a little bit of its own personality. But we found out that if we check the car thoroughly, if we align it and corner weight it exactly the same as the one next to it, then they feel the same. Mostly the difference and what you feel on a car comes from a setup that's not exactly right or exactly the same than on another car. So I rarely hear that on drivetrain issues like you tell me now. So I can't second that.
Well,
from my point.
The car is
maybe
long.
With the white car something was wrong. I don't know.
Let me ask you this, Andres. Those cars, collectors really value those cars, and the values of those 997 GT3 RS 4Os are really up high. Some as high as $700,000. You know, Zuckerman and I feel like
what? That, really? Whoa.
That is a pinnacle moment as far as GT3s are concerned. If there's one modern GT3, it's the 4.0. And I think a lot of collectors feel the same way, as evidenced by the price of the cars. Do you feel like that car is one of your masterpieces the way we do?
It definitely is one of the most famous GT cars we brought out, because I think it came exactly at the right time with the right message and with the right looks. It was different because nobody dared to put a white car on a white car in the market, and white wheels and 4 liter and the whole package was very attractive, and I think the car was really special. I have to confess that we had the RS 4 liter, as a matter of fact, with us. I have some of those cars still. When we go testing with a newer model that is that falls in the same category, we always have the old famous cars in best possible conditions with us to drive them back to back with the newer cars
as a benchmark.
And almost everybody on the team, when we've been out testing with the 911R, liked the RS 4 liter very much for what it is, for the special atmosphere it created. But everybody said, okay, the 911R is just a bit more fun. Yeah. Because the clutch works a little lighter, and the
yes.
seating position
mm-hmm.
is not as, let's say, old-fashioned. You sit a little bit different in a 991, especially mm-hmm. when you look at where's the shift lever. It's farther down on the 997, which when you go back from a 991 into a 997, you have to really adjust for that. Takes a while. It's a great car, but it doesn't offer the same performance as the modern cars if you drive them back to back. The fun factor still is about the same, but I wouldn't say that was the best GT3 there was, because the successor always had a little bit of an advantage about the car that it succeeded. And that's the same with the RS 4-liter. I mean, a 991 Gen 1 3.8 PDK is definitely faster than a RS 4-liter.
Mm-hmm.
Despite having only 475 horsepower on paper, add a little bit more in the engine as well. And the GT3 RS is a little bit different animal. It's more like a a crossover between a driver's car and a performance car. The 991 GT3 is more the performance car, and the 911 IRR was the driver's car. So we split up a little bit. Because in former times, taking everything out of the car made it a performance car, and that was the right and proper way to do it. But with the help of technology coming around that makes a car faster, you sometimes have to invest in that technology first, and or as well in a GT car. Look at the rear-wheel steering. Everybody sneered at us, how can you put in something like that on a GT car? But after everybody drove, they said, okay, you were right, because it just helps, makes the car more agile.
Exactly.
And helps performance and helps create smiles on the faces.
Okay.
So,
Let me.
Sorry, I can't answer that question maybe the way you want to hear it.
No, that was a lovely answer. That was great. I know we can't talk about future models, but we can talk about the 992. As far as future models in general, how does it work? Like, what's the process? How far out do you plan? You're creating a new 911, the 992. You know, how does it work with the stuff that's coming down the pipe? Do you guys get together and pitch ideas? Like, hey, let's do a 356, or let's do a 550 Spider, or... You know,
it's a lot more complicated. We're a big company.
Right.
I mean, in former times when we were doing homologation models for the motorsport, which the GT3 generally is, we took the platform that we had from the standard car, like the Carrera, and got our ideas how we can make it how it can be made faster, aerodynamically better. And it was more a sequential process in the 996, 997 era, I would say. With the 991, we started to be in the first development and concept teams of a new Carrera platform, pretty at the same time with the series development guys, because you have to build in the capability of a GT3 and a cup car into the platform. So there are some things you have to make possible from day one, because if you have to invest heavily in changing body in white after it's already in production, that's a lot more money and a lot more headache than doing it right the first time. So we were in this concept teams, and the 992 especially, you know, we were from day one on the table, me personally and my guys. Hold up the GT flag and say, okay, we need this like that, so the wheel well has to be wider because we need to fit in our tires, and we need that and this and that, from the flexibility or the rigidity of the body in white and all this aerodynamical parameters. So the body in white, especially on the rear of the car, has to endure a lot of load from an RS or GT3 wing. So the wear and tear on the body in white, or the strength that goes into the body in white on a GT car is in some parts of the car totally different to a standard car, and all that has to be put into the calculations and the development of the basis of the platform. So we're pretty much there from day one.
So
in modern days.
So there's no. There's no big pitch meeting. Like, you know, I'm trying to get, you know, how does a car like the Carrera GT come along? How does a car like the 918 Spider come along? You know, as someone who's not part of the car business but in the entertainment business, you know, we have a pitch session, you know, and I imagine if I were in a room at Porsche, I'd be saying right now, hey, guys, let's make a road-going, street-legal RSR for everybody. How about that? You know, do you guys have a meeting where you pitch ideas and have some fun?
There's two ways of doing it, and the way we are doing it, or we are doing it since the GT products are online, I would say, the idea for variant like the RS version, the first 996 RS, for is a good example. It was just it was it's mostly an idea that comes from within the team, and mostly that it's not marketing coming to us that okay, we need an RS version, it has to look like this and that. It mostly comes from ourselves, or not mostly, in every aspect. The Speedster, for example, I had this in my desk drawer since the 996. We wanted to do a Speedster, but it never fit in the whole cycle plan and the production.
That long ago.
And the production plan, and we couldn't realize that. And the RS 4-liter was the same. I mean, there's mostly the initiative or the igniting factor is on the RS 4-liter, for example, was the engine. So we had the R, the GT3R, the race car, that had the 4.0-liter a year or so before, or more than a year before we have started the development of the street going variant. So we have ideas what is used in the motorsport, and said, okay, that would make a great and successful and absolute cool engine for a street car. And so we are drawing some sketches and get together all the data from all the different parts of motorsport, like drivetrain development and body in white and interior and suspension, and put together a package which ends up in a car. And then we have a proposal and we go to the board. Sometimes we build up a car even and show the prototype, the pre-prototype, in the flesh. So we did with the Speedster, so we did with the 911R. So the car was already done one time, one prototype, with all the ideas already in, and you could feel it. You could drive it, you could sit in it, you could smell it, you could hear it. That's a lot more convincing most of the time than only having a sheet of paper with an idea that you have to present on PowerPoint in a board meeting. Mm-hmm. So this goes for this special model, for these edition models, I would say. But the overall life cycle of a product like the 911, I mean, the whole company is involved with that, the marketing guys, the markets even, so they know what kind of car sells well, they know what kind of cars the customers want in the different markets, and this leads to a great pitch meeting, I would say, to some pitch meetings, and so we form the product substance of the cars to come. On a 911, for sure, it's relatively easy because there will always be a 911, and a 911 needs an S variant, and it's a turbo variant, and now it needs a GT3 variant because it's so successful on the market. So that's not a big question of what car to do, how to do it, with what product substance, which is befitting our product line and which is credible for the product and which uses all the technology that's available at the moment. That's more the point.
What a wonderful answer.
This high-end versions, these high-end cars, mostly are Skunkworks projects that come from within the team and get proposed.
Okay, before we go, I just want to ask you a couple questions about your own personal love of cars. What classic car that you don't own, money no object, would you want? A classic car from the past.
Oh, the garage would be full.
I mean, give me three. Go ahead, give me three.
I mean, if I only had one car, one sports car, it would be not one of my products, to be honest. It would be a Carrera GT. I really love that car. I love the sound of the engine. I love the way you sit in it. I love the way the package is, the manual gearbox, the howling engine note, and the performance of the car. I just love the thing, how it looks. So this is my... maybe the most desirable car for me personally that I would buy. I would buy a 365 Ferrari Daytona convertible as well. Why? Uh-huh. Because I'm absolute in love with Miami Vice. So I love this car, this black. And it was a replica. I know it was a McBurney replica. And if anybody out there listens, they have a McBurney replica for sale in black, in black with the right wheels, with the Burani spoke wheels. Give me a call. So I definitely might be in the market for one of those because the 350.
That would be quite a sight.
Daytona is not affordable anymore. I like Lancia Delta Integralis. I'm looking for some car like that for just a while, for quite a while now. I had three of those, and I would like to have one again because it's just an emotional great car.
Wow.
I own a 993 convertible already. That's a Porsche I own. I will own a GT car sooner or later. That's for sure.
Yeah.
What I imagine with the idea to get myself a 991 second gen touring.
Yeah.
I really think this car ticks a lot of boxes for me.
It does. Yeah.
Yeah, and there are so many other cars. I really, I mean, I love muscle cars. I mean, an old 60-ish Camaro or a 65 Mustang or GT500 Shelby.
Yes.
I love that thing. So, I mean, wow. I love big V8s. I'm a boater, so I like boats, and so I love the V8 rumble. And I'm really happy I can hear mine again at the weekend. But I think they're doing a great job in cars as well. And I definitely, when I had a garage of 10 cars that I could buy, there would be definitely at least two or three American muscle cars in it. And I already own a Dodge Ram with a V8.
Yeah.
A yellow one with black stripes. Nobody knows that.
That makes sense.
So I find it very interesting to have these American muscle cars as well in the collection. What else? BMW M3 CSL, lovely car. That would be definitely one I would look out for. I like Ferraris as well. Maybe I shouldn't say that, but the 458 Speciale is a great car. Great car. A lot of fun. And what else?
That's cars. That, Andreas, we've run out of time. What a wonderful interview.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed chatting
so
with
much
you.
Fun.
Thank you for taking the time out on this Memorial Day here in the United States to chat with us. And when you're in Los Angeles and this whole thing is over, we'd love to have you in studio so we can see your face and you can hear us properly. And we can continue talking about the 992 series, which Zuckerman and I both love. You know, we love this new 911 a lot.
That's,
and we're excited about what the future holds.
That would be an honor, and I can only tell you so much. If you love the 992, you will absolutely love the 992 GT3, that's for sure.
That's what we wanted to hear. All right, very good to chat with you again, sir.
I do already, so I can give that away. I do that already. it's amazing. Definitely.
Really?
Oh. Maybe that's the thing that keeps me from buying myself a GT car, because I always know what's coming next.
Right.
And I always say, okay, I wait for that one. And then I wait for another one and another one. But someday I will retire, so I have to make my mind up someday.
You know, our friend Jerry Seinfeld said he really wants you guys to deliver some of these cars with the test mule package on the outside. So the spy shot test mule plastic on a GT3. So maybe consider that. It's very nice to chat with you. That's all we have, ladies and gentlemen. We'll talk to you next week on Spike's Car Radio.
Thanks for listening to Spike's Car Radio, brought to you by Hangar 56. Listen to new episodes every Wednesday, and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.